From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. President Trump responds to criticism of his administration's response to hurricane-ravaged Puerto Rico.
As far as Puerto Rico is concerned, I think just the opposite. We have had tremendous reviews.
Plus, a former advisor to President George W. Bush says America's oil and gas boom is changing global politics.
It has weakened our adversaries, Russia being the most obvious, but it's also created new opportunities for cooperation, even with China.
And Maura Ahrens-Mealy is a successful entrepreneur. She gives a lot of big presentations. But
if I'm speaking at a conference or networking at a professional event, you'll see me rushing for the bathroom to hide because I need some space. I need a break. I want to go home.
Ahrens-Mealy is an introvert, and she says forget leaning in. She's got ideas on how to use inherent skills of an introvert to fashion a new kind of professional success. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In just the past hour, President Donald Trump delivered some prepared remarks in a joint press conference with the Prime Minister of Spain. Trump said he's sending, quote, America's hearts and prayers to the people of Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, end quote. The president then went on to say that Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rossello offered his compliments to the Trump administration.
As Governor Rossello just told me this morning, the entire federal workforce is doing great work in Puerto Rico, and I appreciated his saying it, and he's saying it to anybody that will listen. Our team has been incredible after having gone through Texas and then Florida with other stops along the way. And he further went on, he said, and through the Trump administration's leadership, the relationship between FEMA and my team is very, very strong.
That's President Trump a little earlier today. Now, his tone is markedly different from that of yesterday, when in between a barrage of tweets about the NFL, the president tweeted this about Puerto Rico. Quote, Puerto Rico, which was already suffering from broken infrastructure and massive debt, is in deep trouble. Much of the island was destroyed with billions of dollars owed to Wall Street and the banks, which sadly must be dealt with. He then added, cryptically, food, water, and medical care are top priorities and doing well, hashtag FEMA. So hard to know exactly what the president meant by those tweets, an expression of compassion for the devastated island, or a cold, hard capitalist take on disaster relief. Either way, it put Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rossello in the odd position of having to justify the fiscal management of his government while standing amid the apocalyptic ruin of the island.
Let me tell you something. Puerto Rico had already started doing their part. I was embarking on a very aggressive fiscal agenda. We had reduced, cut over $1.5 billion in our budget. We started reducing agencies, making the changes we had to ensue. But now this is a game changer. This is a completely different set of circumstances, and this needs to be taken into consideration. Otherwise, there will be a humanitarian crisis. Right. There will be massive exodus to the United States. So I call upon Congress to take action, to make their wishes, their solidarity at this moment be something tangible, that it's a bill that actually answers to our needs right now.
That's Rossello on CNN this morning. So let's get some reaction from members of the local Puerto Rican community. First from Otoniel Figueroa, co-founder of the Alliance for Puerto Rico, a Boston-based community organization. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Greg Molina, Director of Communications at the Puerto Rican Festival of Massachusetts. Greg, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna, for having us.
So first of all, Otoniel, let me just turn to you. What do you make of how the Trump administration has responded, or what we know of how they've responded so far to the disaster in Puerto Rico?
We think that the response from the president is an embarrassment. You know, all the news that we receive from Puerto Rico is that this is a situation with apocalyptic proportion. Everything is a threat. There's a public health threat. Water in any point it will be contaminated. The supplies that we've been getting are stuck in warehouses in San Juan FEMA is only working through one distribution center in the eastern point of the island. There are four ports in the south and in the west that the FEMA is not using, that the Coast Guard opened during the weekend, and we're telling President Trump and the elected officials that FEMA should be using that to be able to get the supply to the rest of the island. People are in danger. People will die. This is a matter of days, hours, and the response hasn't been enough.
So, Greg, we heard the president just a little earlier say that he said that Governor Rossello was saying that there was good coordination between what's going on in Puerto Rico and FEMA.
I think Trump is, quite frankly, speaking on both sides of his mouth. I think he's really, really doesn't know the gravity of the situation here. You're talking about 3.5 million Americans that, quite frankly, right now are in a catastrophic situation. He's correct, absolutely correct. You know, we are trying the best we can in the mainland, trying to get first response supplies to these people. But unfortunately, it really is a national attention that it needs. We need some kind of carriers out there. We need more helicopters. FEMA's doing the best they can, working with the local government, working with MEMA from Massachusetts, and also working with the local community. You got people, citizens, trying to clear roads so they can get them supplies.
Yeah. So, Greg, I mean, speaking of state-level efforts, you've been in touch with Governor Charlie Baker's office. I mean, what does state coordination look like right now, and what more could be done?
Well, right now what we're trying to do is, you know, to use the analogy of a traffic jam. Right now Puerto Rico has a huge traffic jam in terms of the goods that they've already received. There are some supplies in warehouses. There are some supplies on the tarmac at Luis Muñoz Marín Airport. There's only 10 flights that are allowed to come into Puerto Rico right now.
Right.
They have to come in during the daytime because the lights on the runway are off after 6 p.m., so, you know, it's a situation that really, you know, they're doing the best they can. The government, local government, doesn't want to create a larger traffic jam. What we want to do is make sure that once FEMA, the federal government, and everybody in Puerto Rico gets the infrastructure to get the supplies to the people, that we already will mobilize and organize and find a way to collect and transport the goods to Puerto Rico.
And Otoniel, I mean, give us a better sense as to what conditions are like on the ground now. Greg was just talking about how flights can only come in during the day. And, you know, what about other basic necessities, food, water, fuel?
We have enough problems in shelters where people are running out of food, out of water. People are going to gas stations to get $20 worth of gas, and they starting at 5 a.m., and they ended up at 3 p.m. getting out of the gas station. At 5 a.m., they get there, and there's hundreds of people. This is a friend of mine that was able to talk to me about this. What we need to understand is the one thing is the relief effort now for Puerto Rico long-term. If we don't get a massive injection of money, a financial stimulus package from the federal government, Puerto Rico will not be able to survive. We're talking about a type of Marshall Plan like Europe post-war received, because after 10 years in economic depression, the FEMA funds will not be enough. Sending relief is not going to be enough. This is deep. This is a catastrophic situation, and the response has been slow. Regardless of what other people say, if this will happen in Texas, if this will be happening in Florida, if this will be happening in Chicago, the response will be tripled differently than we're receiving now. So we're 3.4 American citizens in Puerto Rico that right now they feel that they are worthless, that they're like trash because they're not receiving the emergency help that they should be getting.
So Greg, I'm still struck by how telling it is that the airport can't even stay open at nighttime because of power reasons. I mean, for example, how is this affecting individual Puerto Ricans? I've heard that the CDC is telling people to boil water. Do they have the fuel or means to do that?
You know, I got to laugh. I'm sorry, because obviously, you know, there are people drinking swimming pool water. Okay, that's how bad the situation is. Swimming pool water. Right now, what Puerto Rico needs more than anything else, and Mr. Figueroa is absolutely correct, this is not going to fix itself in 2-3 years. This is going to be 5 or 10 years before Puerto Rico is a shadow of what it used to be. Really, what they need now is monetary donations, okay? People have to do their research, make sure it's a credible organization, because right now what's happening, I just got off the phone with somebody in Ayua, and they were saying that There's no money in ATM machines. The ones that are working, there's no money. So they end up, and when they do find an ATM that has money, they take out $250 instead of $20 that they need for the day, and then the ATM runs out of money. So this literally can be USA's Katrina. The only issue here is it's an island. Mm-hmm. It's in Texas and Florida. You can put a lot of 18-wheelers on the road and bring them the needs and the supplies that they need.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you can't do that in this situation.
Yeah. So I want to ask both of you one last question here because, obviously, clearly, there is extreme acute need right now, when it comes to basic humanitarian needs for, as you said, the millions of Puerto Ricans on the island. But I'm also thinking about what Governor Rossello said in the clip we played at the top of this conversation, that the long-term effort it's going to take to rebuild the island, if it doesn't happen, that he said we could be seeing a mass exodus of Puerto Ricans to the mainland. Now because of the economic situation, the economic struggle that the island has already been in for a decade or so, there has been a lot of younger people moving to the mainland. If that just gets exacerbated by the, I don't know, years-long recovery effort, how is Puerto Rico in the long run going to get fully back on its feet?
I think that one of the main things when we say that Puerto Rico needs a type of a Marshall Plan, we need the federal government to cancel our public debt. There's no way people, my friends and family and the children that I know there that want to stay in that island, that want to stay in the country and help rebuild, are going to be able to stay if our resources end up in banks in Wall Street. That has to stop. And the federal government has the power to make it stop. That's the only way we're going to be able to rebuild our island.
That debt is estimated at something like $70 billion. I mean, Greg Molina, your thought about that?
Yeah, I've heard $78 billion. He's absolutely correct. But that's just one step. You know, the forgiveness of the debt is one thing. I think the whole Jones Act has to be renegotiated. I mean, the tariffs that Puerto Rico pays for goods and services is just astronomical. It's just ridiculous. That island cannot continue to survive with these systems in place as it is right now.
Well, Greg Molina, Director of Communications at the Puerto Rican Festival of Massachusetts, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
And Odaniel Figueroa, co-founder of the Alliance for Puerto Rico, thank you so much.
Thank you for helping us put the Puerto Rico issue out front. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's turn now to some breaking news this afternoon about health care. Senate Republicans have announced they will not hold a vote on the Graham-Cassidy health care bill. That's the latest attempt by Senate Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare. Here's one of the bill's sponsors, Senator Bill Cassidy, speaking just a moment ago.
Through events that are under our control and not under our control, we don't have the votes. We've made the decision since we don't have the votes, we will postpone that vote. Okay. Am I disappointed? Absolutely.
Well, today's announcement comes less than 24 hours after Maine Senator Republican Susan Collins said yesterday that she opposes the bill. She said, quote, in a statement, sweeping reforms to our health care system and to Medicaid can't be done well in a compressed time frame. And she joined Arizona Senator John McCain and Kentucky's Rand Paul, who had also said they'd vote no. Now, here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, the Democrat, a few minutes ago. He says there remains a giant chasm between the two parties.
Every Democratic plan wants to expand health care, help people, more people get better health care. Every Republican plan wants to cut back on health care. That's the difference between the parties that I hope will change now that this bill has been defeated.
Now, as a reminder, Republicans had until the end of this month to pass the bill through the Senate while being protected from a Democratic filibuster. Next month, Republicans would need Democratic votes in order to pass any kind of repeal bill. Pretty much impossible, given unified Democratic opposition to GOP repeal pushes. But as we heard yesterday from a longtime healthcare reporter, Senate Republicans could add new parliamentary language to avoid a Democratic filibuster. So we'll see if the healthcare story is over yet. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Evan Horowitz is here. He writes the quick study column for the Boston Globe, and he joins us on every other Tuesday to help us get our wonk on. Hi, Evan.
Really excited about wonking out.
Okay, great. So, you know, Massachusetts has some lovable nicknames. There's the Bay State. It's a nice one, right?
And then Yeah, it sounds nice.
Then there's, I think, what might be our mutual favorite, right? Taxachusetts.
Yeah, it always reminds me of the Simpsons episode where they go to the 50-state restaurant and Homer complains about getting seated at Taxachusetts.
At the Taxachusetts table?
He's very disappointed.
I can't believe they stuck us at Taxachusetts.
We aimed to please here.
Okay,
so there's Homer Simpson, and then there's the 1988 race for the White House.
That's why they refer to the state of Massachusetts as Taxachusetts, because every time there's a problem, the liberal governor from Massachusetts raises taxes.
Oh, them's fighting words. Okay, but the question is, in 2017, does the state still deserve the moniker of Taxachusetts, Evan?
No. I mean, I could say more, but the short answer is no. Taxes in our fair state are about average, slightly above the U.S. average, behind 18 other states. We just aren't a high-tax state anymore.
Okay, so are we talking about individual income tax?
We're talking about...
I guess that's flat rate, so that was a dumb question. But so what are we talking about?
We're talking about everything. Take it all, add it all up. The property taxes, the income taxes, the sales taxes, gas taxes, corporate taxes. Take it all, everything that cities and towns collect along with the state, and see how much that is as a percentage of our income. And it's about 10.5 cents out of every dollar that people earn.
Okay, 10.5 cents out of every dollar. Again, that puts us in the middle of the pack amongst the 50 states.
Yeah, the U.S. averages 10.3 cents, and here we are at 10.4 cents. That's really, really close.
Okay, but how's the spread? Like, are the high earners, are they paying more overall? Are the low earners paying less? What's the spread like?
You mean in Massachusetts, the distribution? Oh, no, the really, really awful news is that the poorer you are, the more you pay. And the richer you are, the less you pay. This is a slightly different issue. But yeah, we have what's called a regressive tax system, the kind of tax system that nobody would devise, where the more you earn, the lower your overall tax rate.
Yeah. So we should. I mean, I don't even need to remind folks they're living through it. But there was a long term battle and lots of policy changes that led to this because the state was higher than average in taxes a generation ago. But then we had Prop 2.5, for example.
Yeah. Two big changes. One on property taxes. We now have a provision that limits how much, both how much cities can charge in property tax and how much they can increase the property tax every year. And that has lowered the overall property tax rates. And then we had big income tax cuts right around the turn of the millennium. And those also dramatically reduced the amount of money that the state was getting. And together, that dropped Massachusetts down the list of tax states.
But so many people see this as a success. This is a success story, right? Because those folks who thought they were overtaxed in the state now don't have to complain about that anymore, though.
Well,
so what's the problem?
Well, people still complain about it. I got a lot of complaints in response to my piece.
I get that. But what is the problem, though?
So I think in some ways, you can't really measure success or failure based on how high are our taxes. It's just not the right question. The right question is, our taxes are somewhere in the middle, but are they enough to do the things we want to do through government? Are they enough to fund schools the way people want to fund schools? Are they enough to fund environmental programs? Are they enough to fund healthcare? And for the last 10 years, we've run deficits. So the answer seems to be no. Now, this is not necessarily a call for higher taxes. It's a call for equilibration. Either we need higher taxes or we need to finally cut spending. But we've been spending 10 years not doing either of these things and building up debt and kicking the can down the road.
Well, not doing either of these things and actually rolling back efforts to raise certain kinds of taxes. I mean, there was a proposed increase to the gas tax. That got rolled back.
Mm-hmm.
But now we have perhaps, you know, the so-called the millionaire's tax that could become law. Would that solve the problem?
So that would generate about $2 billion in additional revenue every year. $2 billion is a significant amount, which could be used to fill the deficit. There might be some left over for education spending, which would be great. But I do want to make clear, it's not actually that much additional revenue relative to how much money we have. So even if we did this, even if we pass the millionaire's tax, and it'll probably be voters who make this decision, it's not going to vault us back to the days of Taxachusetts. Instead of 10.4 cents on the dollar, the state will be collecting about 10.8 cents on the dollar. It's a relatively small change. Just to put it in perspective, the tax cuts, the income tax cuts around the turn of the millennium, those cost about $4 billion every year.
Huh. Interesting. Okay, so the millionaire's tax could potentially solve some budgetary challenges that the state has. But what about the deeper issue we were talking about earlier, about when it just comes to income taxes? We're looking at what essentially pans out to a regressive system because it is a flat tax. I mean, I'm not hearing anybody in Massachusetts yet saying that we ought to shift away from our 5.25, 5.5, whatever the percentage is now.
I think that's because people tried for a really long time and failed and kept failing and then just gave up, because it's actually a constitutional provision.
Yeah.
There's a provision in the Constitution that says you can't have a progressive income tax in Massachusetts. You have to have a flat income tax rate. That's why the proposal for the millionaire's tax is actually a constitutional amendment. Now, we've tried over the years to have constitutional amendments to allow for broader progressive taxes and say, well, the richer you are, the more you're going to pay in income taxes. And voters voted them down basically every time.
Okay, so we don't like taxes. I mean, nobody likes taxes, as you were saying. Actually, you were saying people wrote to you. What were their gripes about your article?
I think it's mostly eye-rolling. That is, I don't get, you know, reasoned arguments in this case. I get, no, we all know taxes are high. I paid them last year and they were high. So I don't know about that. And it's also, I don't think that people hate taxes. I mean, this goes back now 4 or 5 years, but when Governor Patrick was pushing for a big increase in the income tax, it seemed to have roughly majority support, small majority support to do that. So I do think there are people who want to see taxes increased. But again, I don't necessarily think that's the answer. I do suggest, though, that there's got to be some answer, because right now we have a real fiscal problem. Our budget doesn't add up.
Yeah. I mean, but to be fair, you know, we've been focused on individual income taxes. I mean, property taxes, the rates sort of vary across the state based on what locality you are in. But because property values can be so high, those taxes, they don't just feel big. They are big.
Well,
in the dollar value for folks.
So, OK, in the dollar value for folks. But the good news is folks are pretty well off. So, again, we're talking about averages. Massachusetts is a really, really rich place. Like, if we were an independent country, we would be one of the richest countries in the world.
Some of us would be.
Well, no, the country as a whole. This is what I'm saying.
We have distributional problems, though.
But it matters, because taxes are about how much money we have to redistribute. And the point is, we have a lot of money to redistribute. We have as much money as any country apart from some oil-rich Emirates. We have more money than any European country per person. And we could use this money to deal with the problem of inequality. So talking about average, I think, makes some sense, because you could take the average and then move the money around based on taxes and public spending.
Oh, redistribution, yeah. Moving money around. These are loaded terms.
I understand, but that is the way to fight poverty and inequality.
Okay, last question, since we've been focusing on individuals. What about business and corporate tax stuff?
So here, too, business and corporate taxes are not that high. Now, again, the same problem with the income thing. You can't just look at corporate income taxes. You've got to look at everything. Because if you're a business here, you don't just pay corporate income taxes. You also pay property taxes. You also pay sales taxes on the things you buy. And there are regularly studies when you add these things up. How big are they as a share of profits? And the answer is actually below average.
Okay.
Total corporate taxes in Massachusetts. I know. I hear people rolling their eyes. I'm happy to share all of these numbers. Anybody? They are below average relative to the United States as a whole.
Yeah, but I think part of the reason why people complain, and legitimately complain, goes back to what you were saying earlier, that because inequality here is so great, that for so many people, even our current tax rates do take a bite. Out of the resources they have.
The regressive nature of taxes gives people a reason, a just reason, to complain about the level of taxes. You want, ideally, to have a progressive system where the more you make, the more you pay.
Ideally for you. We can't speak for everybody.
Well, nobody.
There are lots of flat taxers out there who say, so, don't change the system.
So, but left or right, flat is sort of as far as you go on this scale. Some people argue for a flat, some people argue. Nobody argues for a regressive tax system.
I have no pushback to that. So yes. do we need to come up with a better nickname? Like Average Taxachusetts?
Average Taxachusetts, yeah.
Okay, we'll call up the Simpsons and see if they can do an episode about Average Taxachusetts. Evan Horowitz is the quick study columnist for the Boston Globe. He joins us every other Tuesday to, as I said earlier, help get our wonk on. And we'll have a link to his articles at our website, radioboston.org. Evan, thank you as always.
Thank you, Magna.
Well, I'm delighted now to turn to the other person in the studio with me, Megan O'Sullivan. She was formerly special assistant to President George W. Bush, including 2 years as deputy national security advisor for Iraq and Afghanistan. She's now a professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. So, hefty foreign policy credentials. And she says what's often overlooked as a major driver of foreign policy is also its most longstanding and consequential thing, energy. Working in government and in energy, she says, she saw very little intersection between the two worlds, and she writes in her new book that despite energy's huge impact on international affairs, its bearing on politics has, quote, never been less understood. And the new book is Windfall: How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. Megan O'Sullivan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
So at first blush, what you're saying in the book strikes me as totally counterintuitive, because I feel like we hear a lot of politicians always talk about energy and energy independence. So why are you not seeing, or haven't you seen, enough overlap between these issues then?
Sure. No, you're exactly right that the idea of energy independence is something that is very politically attractive in terms of rhetoric. But in terms of understanding what that actually means, what policies would be required to attain that, and even the big question of whether that would be desirable, and I argue in my book that's actually not even something that we should be coveting, that I think there's not enough understanding of how energy markets work. So I often think about it in terms of, as humans, we can only understand or incorporate so many explanatory variables when we're trying to look at any particular phenomenon. So we weight the things that we understand and we discount things that we don't understand. And so in the foreign policy world, you know, technical markets are not something that get a lot of weight.
Well, this seems very concerning, given the importance of these technical markets in just about every aspect of how our domestic economy functions. But in your book, though, you focus on how there's this boom in the U.S.'s energy supply, and that has had an effect on our global power projection?
Definitely. And so the argument is, as many Americans and many of your listeners are aware, over the last 10 years, we had what is really an unexpected boom in the production of oil and natural gas. And so we understand that has delivered economic benefits. But what I really focus on in my book is how that has delivered strategic benefits, because it's changed the environment in which the United States operates. And it's affected, you know, our friends and our adversaries, because not just the price of energy is lower, but also these markets work differently. So, say, Russia is at a disadvantage because of the way the markets are working.
Okay, so let's dig into the Russia example a little bit more deeply then, because, of course, Russia is on many, many people's minds now. I guess oil and gas, big exports for Russia. But how much did the United States even rely on them as an energy source? I thought it was more Europe that needed Russian
oil and
gas.
And this kind of goes back to the beginning of our conversation, is that most Americans, when they think, okay, we have this oil and gas boom, and actually the U.S. has become an exporter of natural gas and of oil just in the last couple of years. And so people think, well, that must mean that we can muscle Russia out of Europe. You know, our exports can displace their exports. And so everybody looks for this kind of foreign policy cudgel. But in fact, the impact is more subtle, but pretty significant. In fact, the U.S. does not import Russian oil or natural gas. Where the difference is that our exporting of this commodity and the fact that we're no longer importing from other parts of the world mean that Russia has to deal with an environment where there's a lot more competition. Mm. And so, you know, its European markets for natural gas in particular are really important to them. And Russians have used that leverage for political purposes. You know, think about Ukraine, but we can also point to other examples. It's harder for them to do that in a world where there's a lot more options for Europe to meet their energy needs.
So then in that case, how should the U.S. use this new leverage that it might have, counter leverage to Russian energy influence?
Right. So, you know, I focus a lot in the book as to what would be the optimal U.S. energy strategy if we're really trying to maximize this moment. So when I was in government and many people before me, the whole idea was our energy situation made us vulnerable. Mm-hmm. It was a vulnerability. And now the Trump administration is the first administration to come in many, many decades that can say, hey, energy is actually an asset. And so the question is, okay, if that's true, and I believe it's true, what should we be doing to maximize this moment? The administration, I think, is overly focused just on production, mm-hmm. trying to figure out this. They have a concept of energy dominance, which seems to mean produce more oil and gas. And I say, sure, that might be part of it, but it needs to be a much bigger conversation. And it's one where we would think about, hey, our foreign policies that seem to have nothing to do with energy actually have a big impact on our energy situation at home.
But wouldn't this be, shouldn't this be within reach? I mean, the former CEO of Exxon is our current Secretary of State.
Right. I mean, you know, as I was saying, kind of the lens that I'm encouraging people to put on when they read the book is, you know, if you're trying to understand today's world, don't just think about it in terms of foreign policy and state-to-state relations and the United Nations and all that. You need to think about energy at the same time. So you think Rex Tillerson would be the embodiment of this, you know, a person who gets the global environment but also understands energy. You know, but thus far, I don't think we've seen him bring the weight of that to bear on our foreign policy. And there could be a lot of reasons for that. You know, my own theory is, you know, maybe he and other people from the corporate world kind of underestimate the complexity of foreign policy making. It looks, and I can speak as somebody who went in and went out, it looks a lot easier from the outside than when you actually get in there and have to deal with all the constituencies, everything that's already in place, the different actors, the different interests. It's pretty complicated. It's as complicated as energy markets.
Yeah. So this is really interesting regarding Russia. I'm also thinking now of Venezuela. The president has been talking a lot about Venezuela recently. How does that factor into what you write about America's power, given that we don't necessarily need Venezuelan oil?
Sure. We actually are one of Venezuela's largest export markets. So the Venezuela story right now, the tragedy that's unfolding there, is related to this boom that I'm talking about in the sense that the low oil prices of the last several years, in combination with economic mismanagement, have really invited the crisis, the humanitarian and financial crisis that the country is going through. And then there are all kinds of options for the United States and other countries to put more pressure on Venezuela by either deciding we're going to stop importing their oil, we're going to stop exporting refined petroleum products to them, or we're going to tell them you can't use dollars to actually facilitate your oil trade. Now, my argument is, you know, some people say the fact that we haven't done that suggests there's some kind of conspiracy theory that the U.S. really wants to keep Venezuelan President Maduro in power. My argument is a little bit different. We have those tools. We could bring that force to bear, but it may not be in our interest unless we have a good follow-on plan to the collapse of the Venezuelan regime. Mm. So you mentioned I worked on Iraq and Afghanistan. If we learned anything, we learned you can't just collapse a government and hope that good things come in the aftermath. You have to have a plan. And I don't see any evidence yet that we have a comprehensive plan that will help the Venezuelans deliver a better future after Maduro. So I think we have to look beyond just using energy sanctions, even though that could be part of the equation.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit more about Iraq, because you have quite a deep and unique experience. You advised President George W. Bush on Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, given what we're talking about, wasn't energy and oil central to reasoning behind the second Iraq war, but to one of the things that pushed the United States into ousting Saddam Hussein?
Well, I do fully admit there's lots of linkages between Iraq and oil and our strategy and all of that. One thing, and I write about this in the book, is that the perception that we went to war over oil, which is common not just in the United States, but in Iraq and in the region, doesn't really stand up under scrutiny. Because if you think about it, there were many ways that the United States could have gotten access to Iraqi oil, well short of sending, you know, hundreds of thousands of troops and waging a war with all the risks involved. At the time of the invasion, which was 2003, Saddam was, you know, cutting deals with France, with Russia, with anyone he could that basically promised, you know, sweetheart deals on oil if a country would just agree to lift the sanctions that were in place against Saddam. So if that had been our objective, all we had to do was say, okay, we'll lift the sanctions, but in turn we want, you know, we want Exxon in there, we want Chevron, we want some kind of special deal. I mean, there's lots of ways in which if oil was our objective, there's a much easier way of getting control of it. But that said, you know, oil permeates Iraq's and Iraq's ability to survive, you know, both as a unified state, but also just in terms of its ability to meet the needs of its people. So I lived in Iraq for 2 years in total, and I spent a lot of time talking with Iraqis about energy, but it was mostly in the context of, you know, trying to protect it because it was the lifeline of their government. And the insurgency that we were battling, the Iraqis and the U.S. and other coalition partners, you know, knew that if they could take down oil infrastructure, that this would really hamper the viability of the government. So energy was something we thought about every day, but not in the sense of justifying why we were there.
Mm. Now, we just have a minute and a half here to go. The book is absolutely fascinating. And I mean, but we're focusing on when we say energy abundance, we've been talking about fossil fuels. And I'm just wondering what you think of, because I personally believe that, you know, in for America's long-term global power, economic resilience, soft power leadership, whatever you want to call it, technological leadership, we can't have this conversation without thinking about clean sources of energy.
Sure. No. And I think as the book does make clear, it is largely about oil and natural gas because it's about geopolitics. And right now, virtually all of the international trade in energy is in fossil fuels. But I do acknowledge that renewables are really having a big disruptive presence in the power sector. And that I think that's going to continue. And that with that big change in the energy mix will come changes in politics. So I think that's, you know, maybe that's the next book I write. But it's definitely one of the things that I spend quite a bit of time talking to people about.
Isn't sort of a reverse version of that already
definitely
happening, because other nations may be speeding ahead on clean energy sources and becoming less reliant on U.S. exports?
Well, so far we haven't seen that yet, but it's certainly feasible. Okay. It's certainly feasible. And I make the argument in the book that actually our backing away from Paris and the climate agreement is not in our interest for lots of reasons, for the soft power that we lost, but also even if you're just narrowly focused on production of oil and gas, the fortunes of our natural gas exports are tied to whether or not big countries like China and India decide to move away from coal. Yeah. So, you know, there are lots of linkages here. And again, my big frame is basically saying, hey, when there's a big change in the world of energy, we should expect a big change in the world of politics. And we are going to be experiencing a new transition away from fossil fuels to more sustainable energy. And that will upend politics all over again.
I have to say, this is sort of more of a reaction than a question. Coming back to where we started, it's discomforting, actually, to hear someone with your deep expertise and knowledge say that you don't think that policymakers in the United States necessarily have the granular understanding of this relationship between big changes in geopolitics and big changes in global energy supplies. I mean, that doesn't fill me with confidence because those changes are coming.
They are coming. But again, these worlds, I mean, there are people who you know, see this intersection. And I'm hopeful that there'll be more and more people. But if you think about it, if you ask most foreign policy practitioners, you know, what is going to shape the global politics in the next 5 or 10 years, they're going to talk to you about Iran. They're going to talk to you about North Korea. They're going to talk to you about ISIS. They may not be cognizant of the fact that energy underpins all three of those issues, and that what's happening in this country is having a huge impact on all of those issues. So it's kind of like a first order issue. since we're in the wonking out hour.
Well, we have a book that we might suggest that they read now. Megan O'Sullivan, professor of international affairs at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. She was also director of Geopolitics of Energy, the Geopolitics of Energy Project between 2004 to 2007, and a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. The new book is Windfall: How the New Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Meghna. Such a pleasure.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Our next guest is a successful Boston-based entrepreneur, founder of the agency Women Online. She's launched online campaigns for the UN, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, just to name a few. I mean, let's just put it this way. She runs a really successful company and has to give a lot of big, important presentations, you know, to say the least. But Maura Ahrens-Mealy is an introvert, and she says that forget leaning in, she in fact leans out. And she's got some big ideas on how to use the inherent skills of an introvert to fashion a new kind of professional success. And she writes about it in her new book, Hiding in the Bathroom, an introvert's roadmap to getting out there when you'd rather stay home. She joins us from NPR in New York. Maura, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Meghna. I'm so happy to be here.
It is great to have you. Now, hiding in the bathroom, is that something that you've actually done?
I continue to do it on a weekly, if not daily, basis. you know, I hide in the bathroom because I am an introvert. I'm not just an introvert. I'm a hermit. I work at home. I like a lot of alone time. I really need to sort of pace out my human interaction. And so when I'm in a situation where I'm with a lot of people, I have to be on, I'm schmoozing, I'm networking, I got to take a break in the bathroom to just sort of collect myself and take a moment. But the truth is, a lot of us do it. We just don't all admit it.
Yeah. I mean, I actually am, according to Myers-Briggs, and I don't know how much stock to put in that, but like I am a hardcore introvert myself.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Very like I score off the charts on the eye. But again, like I guess I should say, like, how is it that you are defining introvert in this case?
Well, you know, the thing is, there's no blood test for an introvert, right? So it is yeah, a little bit of a self-description. And actually, a lot of us are. I guess I'll ask you a few questions.
Oh, yeah.
Here's
okay.
Here's a good question.
Oh, my gosh. You're flipping the script on me. All right. I'm ready.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. That's all right.
I do my best work in a quiet environment.
Yeah. Although, I don't know, where I am in my life, I don't often find myself in quiet environments. But I suppose a soundproof studio is the definition of a quiet environment. So, yes.
Too much exposure to noise and light leaves me feeling drained or spacey or headachy. I hate those fluorescent lights.
Definitely.
Being out and about in a social or a work setting leaves me feeling drained, even if I have a great time.
I'm looking at my whole staff here, shaking their heads. Yes, I love you guys, but yes, you exhaust me.
Well, and also the thing is that you can be on in a really big way, like hosting a radio show, and then go have some quiet time. It doesn't mean you're not an introvert if you have a job as a radio host.
Well, I mean, actually, the truth is, I think being a radio host is perfect for an introvert, right? Because really what I'm doing is I'm talking to you. And it's a very intimate, actually, kind of form of communication, unlike some of the things that you have to do, which is, you know, speaking in front of the United Nations, which seems very nerve-wracking to me. So thank you for defining me as an introvert. I appreciate that. But the thing I really enjoyed about your book is that you say that there are core strengths or characteristics that people who identify as introverts may have, which actually can be seen as advantages when it comes to defining how you're going to be a successful professional. Things like embrace your anxiety?
Mm-hmm. Not every introvert is anxious. I just want to make that clear so I don't get any hate tweets. But a lot of us are. I have a lot of social anxiety. To me, anxiety is a tell at work when I need a little bit more space, when I need to pull back, when I'm out there too much. We all have tells that let us know that our work life is out of sync, right? The thing is, though, if you're an introvert and you can find that balance of enough alone time or working at home or whatever it is you need, and you get out there, you can be the most powerful salesperson, negotiator, etc. Let's face it. Success in our modern culture feels like a man talking in front of a room, right? Mm-hmm. We are all raised with this idea of the sort of garrulous, charismatic, successful leader who is, you know, usually a man talking at us. And so if that's not who you are, it can be really hard. And indeed, some data show that introverts earn less over time, get promoted to public-facing positions less, even though they're equally ambitious.
Yeah.
The thing about introverts is we're great listeners, right? You know that. We're empathetic. We help solve people's problems. And that's why we're incredible salespeople and we're really good at management because we're tuned in. Mm. And so in the book, I actually outline a lot of strategies, especially in sales, negotiation, biz dev, business development, networking, even building your social media brand that allow introverts to use their secret superpowers, put those to work, but also know when it's okay to hang back and work in your yoga pants.
Today I'm wearing jeans, everybody. But to that point, though, you write about leaning out. And that was really interesting to me because, of course, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In book was a giant success. And she is the paragon of the modern day kind of successful business person you were just talking about. So what do you mean by leaning out?
You know what? We can't all be Sheryl Sandberg. She's incredible and she is a role model, even to me. But I would be proud to be called the anti-Sheryl because the truth is, even though I wanted to be Sheryl when I was younger and I tried to work very hard to work my way up in a corporate environment, et cetera, I was a really bad fit for it. I kept crying in the bathroom. I kept quitting jobs. It wasn't in my temperament. It wasn't the right work-life fit for me. And so I had to carve a different path. I'm actually 37% less successful than I would be, I think, if I was a great networker, if I loved getting out there, if I wanted to be more on all the time. But I accept that.
Wait, so
I'm
can
happy.
I just jump in here? 37%? Sure. That's a really precise number.
That's my random number.
Oh, okay.
Some days it's more. Some days it's like 60%.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm out there now, so it's only 37%.
But you say you're less successful. Are you saying like monetarily? Because I thought the whole point of your book is that you are redefining how we might measure success for introverted folks.
Absolutely. But I will be proud to say, I mean, let's face it, I'm a lot less monetarily successful than Sheryl Sandberg. Most of us are. But frankly, I took an alternate path. And by choosing to really control my time, my pace, the space of my work, by working at home in my yoga pants and having a business that is a wonderful business, but a small business, yes, I am less successful by any measure than I was on track to be at 25 when I was an up-and-coming marketing executive, or that many people are who have big jobs and big titles. You know, when we think of success in this country, we think of big, huge, dare I say, unfortunately. And so I'm actually trying to show people that if you are really ambitious and driven, but the life that it would take to be on all the time, to be a wannabe Sheryl Sandberg, just makes you anxious, it makes you upset, it makes you want to hide in the bathroom, you can pull back, have just enough success, and actually look forward to Mondays. Because, like, what's better than that?
Yeah. You know, but part of me thinks that while I welcome your advice and it makes a lot of intuitive sense to me, there are also entire sectors of our economy right now, some of the most exciting sectors, whose they're like driving ethos is different. Like the whole tech sector is all about hustle. Put yourself out there. I mean, aren't people at risk of, well, you write about this, of missing out, or at least being having fear of missing out.
Hashtag FOMO.
Yeah.
We all suffer FOMO. And again, if you're a driven person, and this applies to a lot of people in Boston, I know and love you, you know, we're surrounded by a lot of really ambitious people who are doing really amazing things. And all of a sudden you turn on Facebook and someone that you know or you went to school with or whatever has gotten a round of funding. Someone is doing something incredible with their career and you've chosen to pull back and you feel a little bit left out. We all feel the FOMO. But the truth is, if you know, for example, that you're going to be a happy hermit, that you look forward to Mondays and you do your best work when you have a little bit more quiet time, when you're not out schmoozing, when you don't have to be posting on social media all the time, I think it's a fair trade-off to make. You know, no one tells us to make trade-offs when we're up and coming and ambitious, but sometimes trade-offs can be really good and give you the work life you need.
So, Maura, I'm I'm wondering who this book is really for, because as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, I wish I had this advice 15 years ago, right, when I was sort of starting my career. Because now I'm 15 years on. You know, I've got my home life, my family life. I feel like I'm lucky because I'm able to find the balance or the mix that works for me. But the pressures that you're describing, especially on introverted people, seem to be greater when they're just trying to get their careers off the ground.
You know, I think this book is really resonant with a lot of us. I was just riding in a cab in New York City and feeling just so overstimulated. And as I looked around, everyone was stressed out. They were on their phones. You know, we go to work now. We're in an open plan environment. A lot of people, we're on Slack. We're constantly communicating. We're always on. We all feel overstimulated, whether or not we're introverts. And I think that what I tried to do in this book is give people really solid strategies to pull back a little bit, know when to say no, know what to say yes to, and know how to push themselves and get out there when you need to. But yes, absolutely. I also wish I had had this book when I was younger. Maybe I wouldn't have quit so many jobs. Maybe I would be different. I think that it's a really, really helpful guide for our overwhelming modern times for everyone.
Absolutely. And when you were describing about open office plans and Slack, literally everyone around here was like, you're talking about our lives.
No more Slack.
Well, Maura Ahrens-Mealy is a Boston-based entrepreneur. She's founder of the agency Women Online and author of the new book, Hiding in the Bathroom, an introvert's roadmap to getting out there when you'd rather stay home. We've got more information about the book at our website, radioboston.org. Maura, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.